And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Bill Curtis is a living legend in broadcasting here in Chicago, where he dominated television news as an anchorman for decades, as a one-time co-anchor of the CBS Morning News, and as an investigative journalist and documentarian, including breaking the story of Agent Orange and the horrific impact that it had on so many of our Vietnam veterans. He continues to produce documentaries, and some of you may know him as the genial announcer on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. I sat down with Bill in Chicago recently to talk about his incredible career. Bill Curtis, it's really good to see you. When I started here at the University of Chicago back in 1972-73, I think you were just about, that was when your big run began as an anchor at WBBM here with Walter Jacobson.
Yeah.
So we will get to that. But I want to get to start at the beginning of the story and your family and the fact that you actually weren't named Curtis when the whole story began. Tell me about your folks and your dad, who was quite a military man.
Well, he was. You know, I laugh a little bit because everybody's talking about immigration and we're a nation of immigrants. And it never dawned on me that, oh, my God, I'm like one generation away from immigrants from Croatia. And I was so green coming from the Midwest in Kansas, where everybody just is in the melting pot, truly, that I had to call him. When I got to Chicago, I called my dad and I said, well, what am I? Everybody here, you know, has a nationality.
I just sat down with Lisa Madigan the other day, who talked about moving, or the former attorney general, who, when her mother married Mike Madigan, who's the Speaker of the Illinois House, they moved from the north side of Chicago. She lived on the north side of Chicago to the southwest side. And she said some girl stopped her and said, well, where are you from? What are you? And she said, well, I'm Catholic. No, that's not what we're talking about. What are you? And yeah. She finally said, well, I'm part French, part Spanish. And they looked at her like she had two heads. But anyway, yeah, so Chicago's a town where you have to know your identity.
You do. It's divided. Not so much now. I mean, now it's Hispanic, black, white, yes, if you will. But in the old days when the port of entry was on North Avenue and the Poles, you can still see the Polish newspaper signs up on the buildings. And then they would move. I remember Saul Bellow, who worked here.
Yes.
Used to bemoan the fact of the Russian baths that he was fond of were finally had passed on off Armitage, I think.
How did the Kuratiches get from Croatia to Kansas?
I'm not sure that I know for sure, but most of that eastern wave, especially of young men, came around World War I. And before that, the Tsar was conscripting, folks for his army. It was, I think, around 1912, a little mm-hmm. before the war broke out. And so those who wanted a future jumped on the boat and came over. And they found a part of America that looked like home. The Germans went to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. you know, for the beer. And the Croatians and others and Germans and Poles, some, but went west to find the wheat land, mm-hmm. like the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was Ukrainian, married the Croatian, and flat as a pancake. I went over there and I went to Chernobyl. I was the first guy back in from the U.S. TV crowd.
After the nuclear
yeah.
accident.
And yeah. I looked around and I said, well, this looks just like Kansas, yeah. you know, flat as a tabletop. And very productive.
So your dad was ultimately a general in the Marines.
Yes.
Tell me about him and his, because you moved around a lot, as military families do.
Mm-hmm. It was a great ladder out of a very small town in Kansas. He did go to college and then decided, because it was in the middle of the Depression, around 36, to join. He wanted to fly and had a great talent for flying and became an instructor. So when World War II broke out, he was in Pensacola and Quantico and instructing young men how to fly. About 1944, he finally shipped off to Okinawa and was heading up a unit attached to the 27th Corps for close air support. They were developing, actually, the use of fighter planes flying over the front, our front lines against the troops, which was another tool. You had artillery, and now you had aerial bombardment. He sent 15 squadron or units in a squadron, and they ran into weather and they couldn't drop the bombs. So instead of dropping them into the sea, he called the guys at 27th Corps and he said, "Well, do you have secondary targets? You know, I have 500-pound bombs on 15 fighter planes. Could you use them?" And they said, "As a matter of fact, yes, it's a little risky, but we're going to take the chance. Maybe you will." And the Japanese had mortars on sort of on the other side of a mountain that we couldn't hit with our artillery. And they had pinned down our forces for about 4 days. We can't, they said, we just can't break it. Now, if you can send your planes against our lines, that's what's tricky about it. You usually don't do that because you're taking a big chance.
Right.
We'll take the chance. So one by one, the fighter planes came in. And as the last one came around, released the 500-pound bomb, it skipped and landed right in the headquarters tent of the American unit there.
Huh.
And it was the only one among the 15 that was a dud. And with that, you talk about, you know, the great events that will determine success or failure. He would have been gone if that had gone off. But instead, he was seen as something of a hero attached to a general in charge and then stayed in the Marines.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually how your name got changed, right?
Well, I was 10, and whether it was, you know, hard to spell, K-U-R-E-T-I-C-H, or too much associated with an Eastern Nazi, they were Nazi, they had joined, I think, there in the Slavic country, Yugoslavia. So I don't know.
But the
I know my mother wanted to change it.
Yeah, I read somewhere that the Marines themselves suggested maybe he should do that.
I hadn't heard that, but I think probably for one of those reasons.
Now you, so you wound up back in Kansas. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about this family homestead of yours back there that ends up having a pretty illustrious history.
Called Little House on the Prairie. It is the historical site of when Laura, the Charlie Ingalls family, came from Desmet, South Dakota, down the border of Missouri and then across to the south. It was Indian Territory at the time, 1872. And he built himself a log cabin on what was Osage Indian Reservation. And the true story is that he got in there before he should have and ultimately was kicked off the reservation because he knew that the railroads were pushing, let's open up and move these Indians south. And it now has good research, and it was nailed down by the state historians. We have built a replica cabin, moved my grandmother's one-room schoolhouse on it. And Laura, it was most popular of about 8 books in the series. And so It has become the iconic story of the frontier and living on the frontier. There's a new book out called Prairie Fires, and it's sort of the other chapter, which is telling the truth. Laura's book is fiction, and it was a collection of her anecdotes. But Prairie Fires is really nailed down. And together, you get a feel. It's not the romantic crawling through the tunnels of the tall grasses, trying to find rabbits. And there are the kindly Indians, that are dancing down by the stream. It was the most difficult thing I have ever heard. And most of them, the frontier people who were promised free land and got it when they went out, their 160 acres, or paid a dollar and a quarter. The railroads needed farmers to grow produce that they could then make money on by shipping them back to the east. But there are incidents, the grasshoppers really did come in and can wipe out a crop in. And you could, there were no tractors in the day, so you had a mule and a plow horse, and you could maybe handle a couple acres. There was one story, Laura Ingalls Wilder, Almanzo Wilder was her husband. They were young and in Dismet, which is sort of the old home place in South Dakota, and a blizzard hit. And it was minus 42 degrees. And the whole town, which
sounds
was...
Sounds like Chicago.
Yeah. 250 people, and they had their little ramshackle houses clinging to the frontier. That was the frontier. And all trying to grow and make it. And they were dying. They were being frozen out and starving.
So they headed to Kansas, huh?
Almost. Almanzo heads south to a ranch or farm where they knew he had some stored wheat, and talked him into giving him some wheat, took it back in the blizzard, and saved the town. And they would mix the wheat with water and then fry these little things on whatever they could. But they didn't even have firewood. It was so difficult. And then they ultimately said, got to get out of here, and took the wagon down to Kansas. They only stayed a year. But boy, did she ultimately benefit from that.
I'll say.
And didn't write the book until the 30s.
Mm-hmm. Maintain this as a kind of museum.
Yes. It's now called the Little House in the Prairie Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say it, we emphasize little. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't drive out of my way to go down.
And you had a kind of idyllic sort of life there. In a sense, you suffer for the fact that you have this extraordinary voice that everybody knows, and it kind of eclipses the fact that you've also had one of the brilliant broadcast journalism careers of anyone. When did you realize that you had this gift that would serve you well?
Well, when I turned 16, I know exactly the time. And at that period in your life, your voice is changing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't deep as it is today.
Yeah, some people's voices change less dramatically than yours, I suspect.
But I went down on my 16th birthday, got a work permit, and I went to work at the radio station, the only one in town, Independence, Kansas, population 10,000. And I was able to work 2-3 years in the most formative period of probably any job. It just soaked up everything. Had a very good boss who became a mentor. And I was doing everything from announcing preachers who came across the Oklahoma border and just stood and let the word pass through them, stood in front of a microphone, to Little League baseball and basketball. And I wanted to do it all, touch on it all. So by the time I got to college, University of Kansas, and then on to law school, I had enough experience that I could go to the commercial station instead of the student station.
And you went to the Washburn University School of Law, and I read that you were in a competition at Washington University that was a speech and debate kind of thing.
Yeah, it's moot court, and law students go through that.
But the judge was the thing that I wanted to ask you.
The judge was Harry Blackmun.
Who ended up writing the Roe versus Wade decision as a Supreme Court justice.
And became a giant on the Supreme Court.
He gave you a little encouragement, huh?
He did. He said, you have the ability to make these things interesting. And it's the voice, yes, but it's also telling a story. So here he was. You would think these guys are knee-deep, you know, in the opinions that they are ready to write. But even they, sitting on a bench, probably so bored all day, will
respond to a good story.
Yeah.
Storytelling is the key to everything.
Everything.
I mean, this is why I do this. Yeah. This podcast, because people have such interesting stories. But I think in politics or in journalism, the ability to tell a story well is really so essential to success.
You know, the greatest beginning to a story is Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
And from there, as Don Hewitt of 60 Minutes used to say, just tell me a story.
Right.
And suddenly you're captivated and drawn in. You forget about the world around you, and you're able to. And you know, some of the leading defense attorneys will say that in their closing arguments, they try to be like a 6 o'clock anchor in which you condense and tell it either chronologically or really interesting so that the jury remembers. They're not going to remember 6 weeks of evidence, but here's our story.
Yeah.
Remember this.
Why did you go to law school, knowing that you wanted to be a journalist?
Well, at that time, which was the early 60s when I started, CBS News, the networks, were still using radio personality. The Murrow boys had just come back from World War II, and they were establishing, Fred Friendly claims that he established some of the techniques that we are still using, a reverse shot in an interview like this. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as clear then as, practicing law. Also, practicing law in Kansas didn't have the Wizard of Oz at Emerald City kind of ring to it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, I won't be able to travel at all. So if I go back to my Marine Corps days, born in the Marines there, traveled around where my dad was moving, but I will say that it was very difficult. It was a difficult decision because, you know, I'd gone to law school. When I graduated in 1966.
Difficult to go do journalism instead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were the New York Times was the Emerald City of the day.
Yes.
And the Chicago Tribune, we were far, far from any metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. So it just didn't seem to have the interesting stories.
But you did have one interesting story, which was a brutal tornado attack, and you were on the air at that time, which was everybody's like, you hear about Dan Rather being around there for the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
And that was a career-making thing. In a smaller way, your account of these tornadoes, which I guess you were on the air forever when they struck, was something that got a lot of attention.
Well, it still has the attention today. It was also very helpful for me in making the ultimate decision. I had accepted a job at a law firm in Wichita, finished a course, and a friend asked me to fill in for him doing the 6 o'clock news on the local TV station. And so I went out, and we had some weather. I had been a weatherman for 2 years working. That's my part-time job, getting through law school. And they said, why don't you stick around? We may have to go back on and give either the all clear or add to it. So at 7 o'clock, a time that will live in infamy in Topeka, Kansas, the general manager said, well, let's go break in. And you can give the, not exactly a formal warning, because we hadn't received it yet. And so I was on the air for about 15 seconds and heard a two-way radio come from the newsroom into the studio. And it was our cameraman, and he was on the southwest edge of the city. And he said, we have a tornado on the ground, and it's headed for the city, and it's big. And I didn't want to go with that. I wanted a confirmation of that, because...
As a good journalist would.
Yeah, it's a tornado. And
these are not sound effects, by the way. This is podcast life. These are fire sirens from in the city of Chicago in the background. I don't want you people thinking I'm embellishing this story.
But I might say they're very appropriate to the telling of this story. But the next little report we got is that the Huntington apartments had been wiped out. Well, in my head, I'm still on camera. I could draw a straight line from the original sighting through the apartments, and like an arrow, it pointed to the Capitol building, Washburn, the school. I was married and had a six-month-old child living on campus. So I said, for God's sake, take cover.
Yeah.
And those words now
are famous.
Famous words.
But I'll tell you what, given your voice, that must have sounded like a command from the Almighty at that time.
Well, they got the job
pretty
done.
Persuasive.
Yeah, and maybe it was my sheet white countenance. And you know, you stop. You just kind of change into this very serious message that you're... Well, anyway, we were on for 24 hours. It was the most damaging at the time in the United States. It was an F5 before we even had ratings of F5. And
sadly, we have more extreme weather today. And
So
all these records are shattered.
They are. And more people are living in the path.
Yeah.
Hurricanes, everybody wants a place there on the shore. Well, within 3 months, I was in Chicago.
Yeah.
Which is...
For your first tour of duty in Chicago.
Yeah. And it was a marvelous experience, because it was a 4-year, 66 to 70.
Pretty tumultuous time.
Tumultuous. Here. You know, when I arrived, Richard Speck had just been caught.
Mass well, murder. He murdered, what, seven nurses?
Eight.
Eight nurses.
Seven or eight. Corazon Amaral was the big witness in the
right.
trial.
Right. One nurse, he broke into a home where nurses were dorming, essentially, and murdered them. And there was one nurse who was hiding and identified a tattoo on his arm. But there was a period of time when he was on the loose.
And the city was absolutely
terrorized
to death.
My wife was a young, Susan was a young girl at the time, and she said she was absolutely terrorized during this period. So you were covering that story.
Covering the story, covering the trial, then in Peoria, they changed venue.
They had, by the way, that tattoo said Born to Raise Hell, right? Yeah. Wasn't that the tattoo?
Discovered when he tried to kill himself, and he was taken to county hospital and was identified there by a doctor. So it was an auspicious beginning, as they say.
Years later, you had another report about Richard Speck that made quite a impact, which was how he was living in prison and essentially was sex, drugs, and I don't know about rock and roll, but he was partying down in prison, and it outraged people.
Well, here's the most hated man, certainly in Illinois and perhaps the country. It was a videotape that had been made. They never figured out why. The closest thing, I think, is that there is a jailhouse network of videos that they will do. They have that kind of freedom. Anyway, it showed him stripping down naked with his lover beside him. A pile of cocaine was in front, $100 bills thrown out in front. And he appeared to have had breast either implants or some kind of a chemical
enhancement.
And I'm not sure whether it was that or just overweight, you know. But nonetheless, he had some great quotes. Why did you kill those girls? And he said, just wasn't their day.
Yeah.
Well, what do you want people to know, you know, who see you in here? He said, you know, if they knew how good I have it in here, they'd want me out. Just like rubbing the salt in the
wound. How did you get this tape?
It was given to me as, you know, investigative reporters, you know, don't go in and bludgeon people to give me the story, but they make contacts. And so a lawyer had been given it as a fee, paid for fee. She knew. Whoops, I've just told more than I should have.
Okay, you've you've narrowed the the list of suspects.
But to... I've kept it secret all these years. And so we looked at it, and I said, my God, I don't know what I'm looking at. So we called the prosecutor, and Bill Martin came out, and sure, we confirmed everything. Sat on it for a bit as we were trying to figure out where it was shot, why, when. He was dead at that moment. But when it went on the air, it went on a local station, WBBM, then A&E, crime series that I was starting to produce. It was the most explosive story that I've ever been connected with, explosive in the sense that—
It was shocking.
Shocking, and every television station in the country wanted it.
Yeah.
And they were just all over us, and we were the only ones that who had it.
Yeah.
So when we say exclusive,
it really was.
Yeah, yeah. They could not get it.
You you were here during the period where after Martin Luther King's assassination, when riots erupted in the city of Chicago, you were here during the Democratic National Convention. What were those times like for you as a reporter?
Well, it was, I hate to say wonderful, because, you know, firemen like to fight fires.
Yes.
Police like to solve crimes. For me, I was on the street most of the time. And so I was there at Balboa in Michigan when the demonstrators pushed into the
68
police
convention,
line. I mean, they were in front of me. You talk about history. And for a long time, I mean, I reported as I saw it, but it was not quite as accurate as it should be, because I couldn't be in all the perspectives that other reporters had around. But there was that. And then after King and the cities began to burn, you know, we had a West Side here a few blocks from the University of Chicago. A lot of, you know, and here's the interesting thing. I mean, I was on the street, and we were literally in a car, a crew car, as the rioters were going down the street and lighting with torches houses and shops. And that's being right in it. They weren't interested in us. They were interested in burning the city. The interesting thing is that here was the largest riot that Chicago had, not the fire, that of course was 1871, 72.
Right. Yes, that was epic.
But the riot that the city had ever experienced, and only 11 people were killed, which I say only. That's still tragic, but it was a time when there weren't that many guns available.
Yeah.
And I would then go out to L.A. for the Rodney King riots, and they were much wider spread in South Central.
You did actually in the early 70s a stint in L.A., and you covered, among other things, the Manson trial out there, and you had another encounter with Squeaky Fromm, who would become a Manson, who was a Manson acolyte, who became famous a few years later when she tried to assassinate President Ford. But she didn't like you very much either, apparently.
You know, the family, Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor, was worried that he was not going to be able to convict Charlie because Charlie was never at the scene of a crime, of any of the murders, because he had created these so-called zombies with drugs and sex and sent them off. Yeah. So
we should point out, this is the famous murder of Sharon Tate, the actress, and it was just a brutal, shocking murder by followers of Charles Manson, who was kind of a satanic figure.
Here are young people who are doing Charlie's bidding. Charlie, being the ex-con, spent all his whole life, you know, in prison. And yet, when it came down to it, Susan Atkins and Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel and Tex Watson, the big All-American high school football player, were able to dip towels in blood and write on the walls, pigs, trying to make it look like Black Panthers had created it to touch off a civil war in which the blacks would be eliminated. But yes, Squeaky Fromm, they would camp right out on the sidewalk, and they were sewing a magic vest for Charlie. And, you know, I walked up, and there was a .45 on the table, and I said, I mean, on their seat. I said, I don't know how you're getting away with that. But at night, with my child, and I think of the second by that time, we were out on Sunset Boulevard all the way to the end, almost the ocean, and I had a knock on the door, and a young woman was at the door, and mascara streaming from her eyes. It was raining, and she looked pretty rough. She said, please call the police. Call the police. I need to get home. So I went and I called the police. And almost as soon as I had turned away from her, I came back to the door, and there was a large young man standing beside her. So I've got a picture of large young man, Manson-like follower in front. And I said, well, here we go.
And it was her.
No, it wasn't. It looked like very much like her. And she, they kind of disappeared before the police got there.
I thought. And did you think they were menacing you because they didn't like your coverage?
Yeah, I think they were on marijuana. But Charlie had this ability, or at least a magician-like quality, an illusionist, to make you think that he could communicate with all these people, his family, from jail, even though there was no communication. He didn't even have access to a phone. And so it's perfectly, and we had heard threats that he had sent them out to try and get better coverage. So it, you know, is it kind of in the air? That was a 10-month trial.
Yeah.
Now I'm glad I did it as I look back because of the history making.
Yeah, you had a lot of you covered the trial of Angela Davis, Daniel Ellsberg. Did you get some of these assignments because you had a legal background?
Yes, CBS News, and I was out of the West Coast, and they simply were happening out there.
But then you, in 73, as you mentioned earlier, you got called back to Chicago and to be an anchorman, and you got paired with this fellow who's famous here in Chicago, Walter Jacobson, who was a newspaper man turned broadcast journalist, as volatile as you are calm, a political junkie by nature, and of course that's the civic sport here, and was even more so back in the early 70s. And you guys had like an immortal pairing here in local news, just dominated local news. But I was saying to you before we start rolling that one of the things that was always fun to watch was when Walter would go off and you would gently try and reel him back in, even as all of Chicago was watching. But this is the one that story that I wanted to tell you. The night that there was a hitman named Harry Alleman, who you'll remember, And Harry Alleman walked up to a guy on the street and killed him, and there were witnesses. Those witnesses testified, but he asked for a bench trial, and the judge acquitted him. Judge ultimately committed suicide, I think, and it was...
Took a bribe.
Ultimately, he took a bribe, committed suicide. Ultimately, there was a trial about how that was actually fixed. But at the moment, you know, Walter, I think John Drummond, who was your great crime reporter, was on the
That's right.
street, and John Bulldog Drummond, and John Drummond was reporting this, and Walter said something like, well, what you're not saying, John, but what everybody's thinking is this case was fixed. And I just remember you saying something like, well, Walter, you know, we say things in the heat of the moment that maybe we're not, you know, fully. And you just, you were frantically but calmly trying to reel the whole situation back in. But you had this great run, and then you got summoned by the network to New York, and you did three years as a
morning news
with Diane Sawyer.
Yep.
And that, my sense was that wasn't that satisfying experience for you.
Well, for one thing, you know, you become a network anchor and everybody wants to do it. It's the top of the mountain. But when you get there, you realize, oh my God, I'm not writing, I'm not reporting, because I have 2 hours live on the air of anchoring, and that's what I'm paid to do. And my joy really was in on the streets and actually doing the work of journalism.
And but I should say parenthetically, because I want to make sure that people understand this, you did a lot of investigative journalism. You were the person who broke the story about Agent Orange.
Yes.
And its impact on Vietnam veterans, which was a huge and really distressing story. You went to Tehran and reported from there in the midst of all of the turmoil there around the revolution, time of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And reported on the sort of deprivation of people that
Yes.
led to that. I mean, reporting, I mean, like I said earlier, that you don't get your due because everybody is so transfixed by your voice that all the good and breaking work that you did, path-breaking work, really gets ignored. But no. That must have been frustrating for you to sit behind that anchor desk and not be free to do that kind of reporting.
Well, I was able to use my correspondent background and the argument that, look, this is going to increase the ratings. We were in a very competitive spot. So if you allow me to go to Africa, go to Belfast.
So you did this in that period of time.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh, I see.
And have an investigative unit,
mm-hmm.
Hence the Agent Orange story.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some great general managers, and there was a breakthrough. And I wish that it had continued, although you will see local stations sending reporters abroad if there's a connection.
The budgets are not what they were.
Right. I was in Saigon 2 weeks before it fell.
Mm-hmm.
Went to North Vietnam on the Agent Orange story. Incidentally, 200,000 veterans have been compensated for diseases connected to. 50
yeah.
diseases have been recognized.
Yeah. That's, I think, how you measure the worth of the work you do as a journalist, if it can have that kind of an impact on people's lives.
And that's the key to being a reporter. If we look at what's happening in Washington today, it's in many ways the glory days have returned, certainly with the New York Times and the Post.
Mm-hmm.
Because investigating reporting,
they're shining a bright light in dark
yeah.
corners, which is but what, tell me while we're here, because you sort of made the transformation into documentary work, and you did have a return stint, you and Walter, but you became really focused on documentary work and providing. You still to this day, you and your brilliant wife, Donna La Pietra, have produced enormous amount of material for various cable outlets and so on. But before we get there, I want to ask you about local news and where you think local news is today, because you're quite right that in Washington, coverage is as robust as it's ever been, and there are all these additional outlets on digital that are covering it. But the local news scene is really kind of frightening to me, the sort of diminution of resources for local newspapers, local news, television news stations. I mean, where is this all going?
To digital. And it's not quite there yet. Advertising has left.
Right.
And if you don't have the money to support your efforts, then everything has to shrink. I mean, there are 400 reporters and news people at the Tribune that have lost their jobs. So in many ways, the newspapers are shadows of what they used to be.
I grew up there, and it grieves me.
Oh, me too. I feel so sad. And local news, you know, I think that the reporters are better educated than they ever have been. What happened is that the schools have caught up with the convergence idea, radio, television, writing, and other jobs that you can take, because there's so many kids who want to get into journalism or broadcasting. So, but they kind of come up to local news and it's full.
Right.
And we're not doing the kind of they're doing good jobs with, but it's largely stand-ups in the morning and evening, you know, which
they're not doing the kind of investigative work that Walter and others used to do in the day. I really worry about that. You started Curtis Productions in 1990, the list of things that investigative reports, cold case files, American Justice. Tell me what your thinking was then and continues to be about the work you're doing now. Yeah.
In 85, I came back from New York. I just wanted to do journalism. And in my contract, I wrote in that I was able to start my own company. So while working at the local TV station, I was also forming Curtis Productions. And it was lucky because I was at the beginning of what could be called the golden age of documentaries on cable. Mm-hmm. They were still running World War II documentaries, you know, Hitler going down the street. And they discovered a new formula, and that was local is cheaper. I mean, they're locally original produced documentaries. It was cheaper, and it was able to give them an identity, an A&E, a Discovery, right down the line. And so it started. And investigative reports, I mean, we were into 10 years of that. 10 years.
Yeah.
And Cold Case Files, 7 years, 127 shows. I mean, think about it. We now produce American Greed on CNBC. So in all, probably 500 documentaries out of a little local production company.
And how much time do you spend on these things? I know you voice over a lot of them.
I do. My wife, Donna, runs the company. So we keep it in the family. I just came from a narration session. Climate change is a hot button for me.
Appropriate for someone who covered the weather.
Yes, and into, as one of the solutions, is deep-rooted prairie plants.
Yeah, you have another enterprise.
Yeah, that soaks up. Not only are we experimenting with it at one of our locations, but it soaks up more carbon than almost any other thing besides ocean. And because the roots go down 15 feet and they are filled with billions of organisms that all eat carbon. So it'll get here. And I believe in my mind that we all kind of know about climate and the problems, but a panel issues a report which says, you know, we're going to be in major trouble in 10 years. 10 years.
Yeah.
We're talking about, and you look at the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we've already gone over the warning signs.
No, look, I think this is a existential crisis.
Yeah, but why doesn't anybody react? I mean, even Congress.
You know why? Because there are, you know, some economic ramifications for it, and because we're never very good at dealing with problems that are 10 years down the line. Now, if you are watching the news, or if you live in California where they're constantly dealing with wildfires now, or you look at the magnitude of the storms that people are dealing with up and down the eastern seaboard or in the Gulf, you know, how much warning do you need? I mean, all of these forecasts that we've been hearing for years are now coming to fruition, and we've suffered the warmest 5 years on record in the last 5 years by the government's own reckoning. One person who's not a big consumer of this data is the President of the United States, however.
And it slowed it down. Mm-hmm. And the strategy of the big economic giants, oil companies and others who don't necessarily want to cut back on their emissions, is to find that a scientist that happens to be a denier and fund him and support that. It's the same strategy that was used for cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it just delays.
I think the thing that makes it more insidious and difficult is that there are outlets that have big followings that are willing to popularize those kinds of outlandish and outlying scientific theories. I have to ask you, in addition to all the other work you've done, you're quite a photographer, and you've had books of photography, and talk to me about imagery and what photographs, both film and still photographs, like the ones that you've taken, do to animate a story.
Well, you have to have television, as that's what it's all about. Motion pictures, still photography is coming back, I think. It was replaced by digital, you know, and I put it off for an awful long time because you have to know computers and all the little gadgets. But
what attracted you to, what caused you to take photographs?
I was at the scene of so many things. Fires on the West Side, the Democratic Convention, the Manson trial. So I said, you know, I'm here. I better start taking pictures. Mm-hmm. And that helped because the substance of that imagery carried the day. I didn't have to be Ansel Adams. Mm-hmm. But I picked it up, and it became more than a hobby.
I want to ask you about, you know, you describe your life, and people will say, this is an extraordinary life. By the way, we should add that you replaced in 2014 Carl Castle on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You probably have a whole new generation of followers for your work on that. In the movie Anchorman, and you probably have a whole generation of followers as a result of that. But your life hasn't been all, as most lives aren't, unchallenged. You married your high school sweetheart. She died quite young and of cancer. And you had a son who struggled with schizophrenia until he took his own life. How, you know, I raise it because I feel so strongly that we need to talk about these things, particularly mental health issues, and treat them as the illness that they are and not as some sort of character defect. So tell me about your son.
Well, it's more important now than ever because the shooters responsible for all these mass murders.
Yeah, that's a common thread.
That's right. And so we have to find out how we can better identify those that are going to be violent. Mm-hmm. I took my son to the Menninger Foundation, which was the last remaining long-term mental health facility in Kansas. And they have now moved to MD Anderson. And they said, he's not the violent type. But schizophrenia is hard to detect. It happens around 19, 20 years old.
And is that what happened with your son,
uh-huh.
Scott?
I believe, among several theories of why it happens, that there's a chemical in the brain, dopamine perhaps, that turns off. And they begin to have hallucinations, audio problems. They described it to me, and there are different descriptions, that, you know, you can go to a movie or go to a concert, and you go home and you go to bed, and all those senses turn off. But for a schizophrenic, they don't. So his head can be filled with voices that are terrible toward him, telling him, you know, your father is the devil, you have to kill him, and lead them, you know, to violence. And of course, there are 1,000 different kinds. Anyway, Scott lived with that. I felt so sorry for him because one of the things that happens is that they're unable to hold a job because their attention span is not any good. They're dealing with all this inside their head, at the same time trying to live, work, be normal, which they can't. So it becomes just this crushing negativity.
And he was perfectly normal as a younger child?
Up to that point, mm-hmm. 19, 20. And then it takes time to determine whether this is bipolar now or schizophrenia mm-hmm. or just being a teenager. And, you know, the drugs, the medications. In 1968, many of the states, including Illinois, closed the so-called snake pits, the warehouses for the mentally ill.
Right.
And the theory was, well, we're going to put them on the street, and they're going to administer their own medications. Administer their own medications. What are we, nuts? We're trying to save money. So
it's also true that these places became kind of warehouses and that people were kind of neglected and abused.
Something had to be done.
Right.
But instead, we now have, I think, a terrible mental health system. There's no place to go.
Yeah.
So consider this. You're a parent. You have a child. They're different. They spend, you know, all day in front of a computer. The parent has to go in and look at the computer and what they're doing there. Mm-hmm. In the Columbine killings, they, you know, had essays and plans almost for a year of what they wanted to do to the people in the school. And so the big problem, I think, these days is to, one, come to grips with the fact that your child has a problem and may develop a violent, whether they have or not, a tendency. And how are you going to commit them? Well, if you commit them, that probably means more than a psychiatrist. It could mean to a state hospital.
Institutionalized.
And that is sort of the end of the world for a lot of parents. Here's a tip. Remember Gabby Giffords, who was shot in
right.
Phoenix? I saw an early story that came across that said her the young man
Jarrett Lagner
Jarrett, was, took a bag, presumably of weapons, and got in the car and drove off away from the house. His father saw that. He said early in the game, "Yes, I saw that, and I went after him." That means his father knew something. Whether, you know, the violence hadn't happened yet, but he knew something was wrong, and he knew that something could happen. So people know. And parents, I think, have to be given sort of a guide. Mm-hmm. Here's what you do.
Did you, how did you deal with your son's illness, and were you monitoring him in that way, or and what was, I mean, I guess he died on your farm, or
yes,
and
I did not have him at home, and he actually left for several years and doing what he wanted to do, and so I bought him a small house in the town that is adjacent to the ranch. Because Menninger's tried to teach them to be independent, mm-hmm. and so they can live life on their own terms. And I had a cousin there and appointed a guardian, so they would come and administer the medications every day. Scott, the problem is the medications caused him to gain weight. So by the time he died, he was 300 pounds.
Oh, my.
Grotesque. So just being that obese prevents you from living up to mm-hmm. any dreams. So I actually, and the sheriff knew, the police knew, it's a 1,300 population. The other people in town, well, that's Scott, you know, and they'll mm-hmm. kind of, and they weren't afraid. So I set up my own mental health mm-hmm. System. Obviously, didn't do any good. We didn't have anything to cure the disease. We cannot cure it, mm-hmm. but we can support. It's like an alcoholic. An alcoholic can run the life of a family, ruin it in many cases, but it takes all the money they have to send them off to treatment. And Scott would go back into the hospital probably every 6 months. He would act out and kind of come to the end of those medications. And then he would get his retuning and come out after about 6 weeks and be fine. But it was the back and forth, back and forth. And Kansas has a pretty good mental health system. They have a, you know, but it costs money.
Yeah.
In a state that doesn't have any to begin with. So everything is...
So when you got that call, you weren't entirely surprised, huh?
No. My daughter called me, and she wasn't sure whether he killed himself or just died.
Mm-hmm.
He had diseases that kind of associated.
Well, obesity, you know, of that.
Well, obesity and pancreatitis mm-hmm. and diverticulitis and, mm-hmm. you know, you could kind of go down the list. It's a terrible life, and the ripple effect affects so many people. It's good to talk about it. I did not talk about it. I did not want to exploit it, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I have since had people, the minute they hear, you know, and they will come to you and say, "Oh, my God, we have that in our family."
Everybody's a regular listener of this podcast knows that my dad committed suicide. And, you know, I talk about it, and I didn't talk about it for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about it because I realized, you know, I didn't want to stigmatize him. But that's exactly why he didn't get the help he needed.
Yeah.
And the best thing that we can do for people who are struggling and their families is to encourage them to get the help that they need and the guidance that they need to deal with what is an illness.
No. You know, medications can stop the voices and the hallucinations, but, you know, then you have other problems pop out. First thing that some of these kids will do is go right to the drugs. I mean, opioids.
To self-medicate.
Yeah, self-medicate. And you know, for terminal patients in cancer or anything, I say, you know, they should have any drug they want to improve their life at all.
The problem is that we have more and more people self-medicating against problems that are, you know, either mental illness or other stresses. And
yeah,
I mean, we have an epidemic now. So, well, these are sobering challenges, and I think it is important that we talk about them. It's good that you're talking about them. I just want to, not to go from the sacred to the, I don't want to say profane, but I want to get back to politics for 1 second. You have a sister who was in politics in Kansas, and what's interesting to me is that she was a Republican, and but she switched parties. Tell me about her and her role in politics.
She was a state senator for 13 years. She had an expertise in education. Education is the hot button there.
Yes.
They're still behind, I think, $300 million. Seems like a lot of money. She just kind of came to the point where an extreme section of the Republican Party had taken over the State House.
Yeah, Governor Brownback.
Yep. And we're doing some things that she didn't like. She loved the politics, so she said, I'm going to change. You know who had beaten her in a race for Congress in her little district, Southeast Kansas?
So Mike Pompeo defeated your sister?
Yes, Mike Pompeo. And who would know at the time? He was very conservative, right in with the rest of the...
Koch brothers support, probably.
Very much.
Yeah.
And one could say they run the state because of all their support. And he went on, you know, he was in Congress.
Yeah.
And made his conservative connections.
Yes.
And they liked him.
Yeah.
He may have been the most successful member of that cabinet that we have.
Lot of speculation that he may run for president if... in the post-Trump era. So it all began with your defeating your sister, apparently.
Well, then she ran against Kobach, who was the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And was also defeated. Kobach is now famous for putting a 38 caliber machine gun on the back of a pickup and... and entering the political parades in the little towns of Kansas.
For all of the stuff that he's done, anti-immigration, he was the chairman of the president's vote fraud commission that couldn't find any vote fraud.
Yeah.
So he's made quite a name for himself and just barely lost a race for governor last year. Bill Curtis, it's really great to see you. I want to thank you for being such an illuminating force here in the city of Chicago and beyond for all these years. And I look forward to what you do next and to hearing you every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
David, back at you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit axefilespodcast.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.